Tonight's speaker is Jean W. from Seeger, New Jersey, and tonight she's going to share with the group exactly how she applies the steps into her life one day at a time. Please welcome Jean W.
Hey, y'all. My name is Jean, and I am a grateful alcoholic.
Hi, Jean.
I was fine till I walked in the door, and I didn't make it home in time to eat dinner, so I grabbed some Chex Mix that I made myself. And I would have my knitting. I was going to sit in the back of the room, and I was going to eat my Chex Mix, and I was going to do a little knitting on these socks that I've been trying to make for my son-in-law and mind my own business, which you, those of you who know me, is really not the truth. Too many people in this room who know me, a lot who know me better than I know myself, so I have to be really careful. And when I walked in the door, Billy asked me what I was doing tonight, and I said I was sitting in the back of the room. And he said, well. And, you know, one of the things that we've all learned in our time in sobriety is that when someone asks you to do something, if there, as long as there's not a valid reason why you can't, you really should. And so I did agree to do this. Those of you who know me know that every time I'm asked to do this, it doesn't make any difference if it's 500 people or if it's 10 or 2. I always feel like I'm going to throw up. And I do feel, again, it started as soon as I agreed that, yes, I would do this. So, of course, now I just feel like I'm going to throw up. I won't, I promise you. I promise you as I get into this, the butterflies go away and my stomach settles down and I seem to do okay. So I want to thank Billy for asking me to do this. It's always an honor and it's always a privilege to be asked to do anything for Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, there was a point and place and time in my life when nobody would have asked me to go across the street. Most people were asking me to leave rather than to stay. And so today that's one of the gifts that sobriety has given me. There are a couple questions that you might ask me to find out where I am in my sobriety. And the first question that you might ask me is, what is my sobriety date? And my sobriety date is May the 12th, 1983. And that is a gift in my life. It's a gift in the lives of all the people that I touch. It really is. It's a gift in the lives of my children who grew up with a drunk mother. It's a gift in the lives of my grandchildren who have, thank you God, never seen me drunk. And God willing will never see me drunk. I just want to make a little aside because I know that if I don't get this stuff in, then I forget. You know, when it goes in my sick head, I have to get it out. I don't know if anybody else will find this funny except for me, but I laughed so hard over the weekend. My grandson, who was 8, made his first Holy Communion. Now, not being of the Catholic faith, I really didn't know what we were getting into, but my son-in-law is, and God bless him, he's, you know, taking real good care of raising those children. And I have to tell you that this 8-year-old in his khaki pants and his navy blue blazer and his white shirt and tie was, he was a piece of work. And my daughter leaned over to me, and one of the things she said to me was, you know, Mommy, I really have to remember how he looks right now for those times when I'm ready to kill him. You know, and that was true. But Dan, for whatever reason, I don't know where this has come from, is on a money kick. Money is real important. I mean, there's nothing he would rather do than open envelopes full of money. He watched his cousin do it weekend before last and started to pinpoint the people that were there in Rochester, New York, no less, who he decided should be invited to his first Holy Communion because of you know, the money. Well, anyway, the kids were to make these banners and hang the banner on the pew where their families, their felt banners, they're about this big. And they could put on them whatever they wanted. So as I walked in the church, I look up and down and I see these really nice banners. One says, God loves me. The other one says, God makes me smile. And then we get to our pew. In God we trust. You know, and what was so wonderful for me was that this is something that I would have missed. if I hadn't gotten sober. You know, this is one of those wonderful things that I would have missed. And so I'm so grateful that that I was able to make that. The second question you might ask me is, what is my home group? My home group is Sigurd Thursday Night, and I believe it's the best home group that there is. I know that there are people in this room who would disagree with me, but that's okay. You know, with a dissension is not a bad thing sometimes, and I do believe it's the best home group. I like to tell this little story because it wasn't always my home group. I got sober in this area. And my very first home group was They Had Lost and Found. And that was my home group because that's where my sponsor went, and that's where my sponsor told me I was going. It wasn't that I had much of a choice. You know. And I did believe then that it was the best home group for me at the time. And then I had a lapse of memory, and I got remarried, and we moved to South Carolina. And the day after we got to South Carolina, I had a cat adopt me. And so I kept the cat, and I got rid of the husband, and I got the best end of the deal. And but I was there for 11 years, and I had a fabulous home group. And I do believe that I am still a member in good standing of the Higher Power Hour. And they meet on Mondays and Wednesdays at 7 o'clock at St. Paul's Church, corner of Pitt and Queen, in the old village of Mount Pleasant. And if you're ever down there, please go visit them and tell them I sent you. And then I came back, and when I moved back here, and it's not quite 5 years, it'll be 5 years next month, and I don't know where the 5 years went either. And when I came back 5 years ago, I went back to my old home group because that was the home group that I knew. And we all know that people change, you know. People do change. And I was there for quite a few months, actually. And for whatever reason, I can't tell you. I think it's where I was in my sobriety. I know for a fact it had nothing to do with that group. But I do know that it had to do with where I was in my sobriety at that moment. And I just was not getting out of it what I wanted to get. And as a result, I wasn't able to give to that home group what I felt I needed to give. And so I went looking for a new home group. And what always boggles my mind is, of course, Sigurd Thursday Night has been there forever. Was literally around the corner from where I lived before, you know, which shows you where my head was. And so I did join Sigurd Thursday Night. I am now going to irritate some people, and that's okay, because I really don't care anymore. You know, it's not necessary for you to like me. That used to be very important to me, but it's just not that important anymore. And I do want to say something about a home group. I know, and I say it when I speak from any podium anywhere, I know and I understand that service work is not for everybody. I understand that. I understand that there are people who do not want to get involved in district level work and in area level work. I understand that. What I do not understand is when you ask for members of the home group to raise their hands, and you get 60 hands raised, and you have a business meeting, and 5 people show up. Now, my opinion, and I will say it from the podium, and I will stand behind it, my opinion is raising your hand does not make you a member of a home group. What makes you a member of a home group is giving back to that group what that group brings to you. What makes you a member of that home group is taking a coffee commitment, is arriving early and greeting people at the door. What makes you a member of that home group, if it's an open speaker meeting, is taking commitments and going out on commitments. That's what makes you a member of a home group. What makes you a member of a home group is being the secretary, is being raising your hand and agreeing to clean up. You know, that is what, in my opinion, and it's my opinion, that's what makes you a member of a home group. And if I can't give 110% to my home group, then I have to go find a home group that I can do that. And that's what I found when I joined Sigurd Thursday Night. I have been their secretary. I have been their GSR. I have helped to clean up. You know, I attend every business meeting because that's part of what I need to do. Now, for this alcoholic, where I find my biggest reward is in service work. And so, therefore, I now serve as your district secretary for District 28, and I love it. I love every minute of it. I'm sorry, I'm going to have to rotate out in January. I'm going to have to go find me another district job because I don't want to get out of service work. Service work allows me to give back to Alcoholics Anonymous what was so freely given to me when I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's the end of my lecture. But I'm just so passionate about it. I really am. The next question that you might ask me is, who am I sponsor? And I happen to have two sponsors. I have the same sponsor that I had from the minute I walked into these rooms some 21 years ago. And her name is Marge, and she lives in Brick now. Actually, she lived in Point Pleasant. And the first night I met her, I knew that she had something that I wanted. I was sitting at a table. It was my second AA meeting, and I had my little book and whatever, and I was trying to get numbers, and I was asking for numbers, and this woman, and she's not a small woman. I will not say she's overly large, but I will not say she's small. And she came across that table so fast, and she grabbed that book. I will never forget it as long as I live. And she started to hand it to certain women and ask them to give me their phone numbers. Now, at the time, I did not understand why she was doing what she was doing. I understand it today, and I do the same thing with newcomers. What she was doing was giving my book for numbers, my telephone book, to those women who had good sobriety. I didn't know. It was my second meeting. You know, we always hear about stick with the winners. Well, she was making sure that the numbers that I received were numbers of people who could help me and would not hurt me. As I say, I didn't understand it in the beginning, but of course I understand it today. And then when I moved to South Carolina, and I tell this from the podium because it's not something that I recommend that anybody do, and it embarrasses me every time I do it, but then I need to always tell on myself. And when I moved to South Carolina, I went 5 years without a sponsor in South Carolina. I'm embarrassed to tell anybody that, for somebody who's so passionate about her recovery and being active in the program and the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's more of talking the talk and not so much walking the walk. And today I'd like to believe that I walk the walk pretty good. But I got into a lot of trouble when I was 10 years sober. My life was falling apart. I woke up one day and I walked in my bathroom, and no matter where I have lived and no matter what bathroom there has been, I have a sign on my bathroom mirror. And the sign on my bathroom mirror says, "You are looking at the problem." And every morning when I stand there and I look, I see the sign. And it tells me I'm looking at the problem. The problem is right here. But if I'm looking at the problem, I'm also looking at the solution. And I got in the bathroom that morning, and I looked at this sign, and it said, "You're looking at the problem." And I burst into tears, and I said, "I did not get sober to be this miserable. I just did not get sober to be this miserable. I want to be this miserable I could go and drink." And I realized that I had made a terrible mistake. I had made a very poor choice in judgment, and I had made a bad decision, and I had gotten married, and I shouldn't have, and I was in that marriage 6 years at that point in time, and I was in so much pain, I truly believed I was going to die. I really believed that pain was so bad. I just thought I was going to die, and I just couldn't live like that. I couldn't do it. And I was in private law practice at the time. I'm a paralegal by profession, and I was doing some private practice at the time, and I walked into Cummings' office that morning, and I said to him, "I can't do this anymore." I said, "I don't know how to get out of it." But I said, "One of the things that I have learned, the lessons I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous, is if I don't know, the answer or how to do something, I know somebody who does. And I know enough nowadays to turn it over to that person and let that person do the work. And so I said to him, I don't care how you do it, but just get me out of this. Just get me out. And I picked up the phone and I called Marge, and Marge said to me, call your sponsor. And I said, I am. And she said, no, I said, your sponsor there. And I said, I don't have one. And she said, well, you will by 5 o'clock tonight. And you will call me and you will give me her telephone number and her name, because I think I might have to call her up. And so I was very fortunate in that there were two women who had relocated to Charleston, to the Charleston area from New Jersey. They were very well known in recovery in New Jersey. And so I called one of them up, and her name also is Jean. And I called her up and I said, will you be my, you know, I don't know about anybody else in this room, but I know about me as an alcoholic. If there's anything I hate, it's I hate reaching out and telling somebody I hurt. I still have this brick, that this wall that is there that, you know, I'm just fine. Thank you. You know, I don't want you to know that I really, really hurt. And, you know, and I hate to ask for help. So, anyway, I asked her, and she said she would be glad to. And so for the next 6.5 years, she walked with me on a walk that sometimes made us laugh and sometimes made us cry. And she held my hand, and she took me to the hospital when I had to have surgery. And, I mean, she's a wonderful lady. And so when I moved back up here, of course, I had Marge up here, but see, I couldn't let go when I moved there, and I can't let go now. I just can't do it. I can't do it. And I talk to her on a regular basis, and I love that woman dearly. I don't think I'd be sitting here tonight if it had not been for her guidance. I do know that her favorite expression was, this too shall pass. I used to tell her if I ever heard it one more time, I would put something in her mouth. But you know what? She was right. She was always right. You know, it's that, I always say it's that person in my life who loves me enough to tell me the truth. You know, and that's really so important. It's so important for this alcoholic. And the next question that you might ask me is, where am I in my journey in the steps? A couple of minutes ago, I was in the third step, turning my will and my life over to the care of God. And I always do say a short prayer before I'm asked to share from any podium. And I ask God to please allow me to get out of myself long enough to tell the truth. Because, you know, there are still some times here that I want you to think it was a little bit bigger and better than it really was, because it wasn't pretty. But most of the time today, for whatever reason, I can't really tell you, I find that I'm in the 11th and the 12th steps. I'm still trying. I got to talk to Tom Manley about this. I still got to learn how to meditate, you know, and I just think he'd be a great teacher. I just really do think he would be a good teacher. And I'm not really good at shutting my mouth and closing my mind, you know, opening my mind. I don't know why. I'm turning the brain off, I think. Sometimes I think I do meditate and I don't know I'm meditating. I am still trying to improve my conscious contact with this God of my understanding who has just been so unbelievable. Just so unbelievable. I mean, took this 24-hour-a-day falling down drunk, you know, and never dropped me. You know, just never dropped me. Carried me, you know, carried me until I was able to get some recovery under my belt and maybe start to carry myself just a little bit. And then as you heard me pontificate a few minutes ago, I'm always in the 12th step. I find working with others and carrying the message gives me some of the greatest pleasure in my life. It really, it truly does. I'm honored. I've been asked to do a presentation up at a meeting in Rockaway this month, every Thursday, three Thursdays. And they've asked me to go through the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and do chapter, whatever the chapter, I don't know what the chapter number is, it doesn't matter, working with others. And I chose that specifically because I feel very comfortable there. And so I am looking forward to going and doing that this month. It's a privilege and a pleasure. Anyway, I was born in an alcoholic home. My mother was a daily drunk, and my father was, in my opinion, a periodic. I can't call him falling down drunk, but what I do know is that when he drank, he got drunk. My mother, we all know, was an active alcoholic, and she died a horrible alcoholic disease death. It was just not pretty. And I have twin brothers who are 3 years younger than me, and I don't know who took care of me when I was little, but I know who took care of my brothers when they were little, because I became a mother to them when I was about four, and that was my job. You know, my job was to keep them quiet. You know, so that they wouldn't wake my parents on weekends when the hangovers were raging, and, you know, just to keep everybody quiet. And I never realized, you know, how much I had done until I got well into my adulthood. My father was a very successful attorney, municipal bond attorney in New York, had his own law firm, and, on the outside, everything looked really terrific, but as for many of us who have grown up in various homes, what looked good on the outside wasn't so hot on the inside. And I grew up with a lot of anger and resentment and a lot of fear, and I spent a lot of time up in my room with a blanket over my head, trying to shut out the screaming and the hollering and the yelling, and listening to the door slam and wondering who left and were they coming back. And I also grew up with this feeling that it was my fault. Now, I don't know where that came from, but I did. And I grew up with this feeling that it was my fault, and that maybe if I was a little bit better, or maybe if I stayed out of the way, you know, maybe things would be better. And they didn't get better. I had my first drink, my first drunk, my first blackout when I was 15 years old. I love to describe it because it just feels good. You know, it still just feels good. You know, and my boyfriend and I went with a group of kids, and we went into New York City, and the drinking age was 18, and I was 15, and I could look 18 any time I wanted. And this was back in the mid-50s, and we went down the stairs. Anybody that's as old as I am or in that age will remember that they had fabulous jazz clubs. I mean, they were just fabulous. You went down the stairs and the smoke, oh, and the music and the atmosphere, oh, fabulous. Now, I don't know whether I had a drink before this, but this is the drink I remember. And I didn't know what to order to drink, but I heard somebody say they'd have a 7 and 7, and that sounded good to me, and I had a 7 and 7, and took that first sip, and I can feel it tonight, burning right down, just burning as it went. And when it got down, the heavens opened up, you know, and I found a friend. Alcohol did for me what I could not do for myself. Alcohol made me pretty. Alcohol made me able to talk to boys. Alcohol allowed me to dance. Alcohol allowed me to do everything. And that was the beginning. And I had my last drink and my last drunk and my last blackout when I was 45 years old. And if you can add, then you know how old I am. And if you can't, that's okay, too. I'll take 52 would be nice. Keep dreaming. And I abused that alcohol for 30 years. I did all the things that those of us raised in the 50s did. I went to high school. I went to college. I went to college for one reason. I went to get my MRS degree. And I met my future husband the second week I was there, and 3 years later, we got married. I married an only child who was smothered at home and who wanted to get out of that house. And I got married to get out of that house, you know, and I figured this, I was now going to be the queen in my castle. And guess what? Kings and queens do not rule equally. It doesn't happen. And I did not rule equally, and I kept going down this ladder. Alcohol was not a problem in our home when I first started to drink, and when we first got married, my husband could drink anybody under the table, but he'd just soon have a glass of milk as he would have a drink, you know. So alcohol really was not a problem in my home. We did not have cocktail hour. You know, and he didn't walk in the house at night, and we sat down and had a drink. He walked in the house. He wanted his dinner on the table. That's what he got. After we married a couple of years, I had my first daughter, and then about 22 months later, I had my second daughter. And I stayed home, and I raised children. And then he went to work, and he started to climb the corporate ladder. And pretty soon, every time he climbs up this corporate ladder, we got a transfer to move. And every time we moved, the same thing happened. He went to work with the people that he knew. My children went to school and made their friends, and I sat in an empty house with a telephone that didn't ring until I managed to get myself involved and in all kinds of communities and whatever, and I would just get myself set, and I would be comfortable, and he'd get another promotion, and we'd get another transfer, and off we would go. And what happened to me was slowly but surely, and it was very slow until the very, very end, slowly but surely my drinking increased. In the beginning, it was just weekends, and, you know, if it was available, it was available. And, of course, I would wake up on Sunday morning, and I would say, I'm never going to do that again. Well, of course not, not until the next weekend. And somewhere along in the late 60s, I guess it was, we were living in probably the worst place I've ever lived in my entire life. No offense to anybody here, but we were living in Huntington, Long Island, and that was without a doubt the most awful place I have ever lived. It was so bad that my drinking increased to about 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I would have to start, and I was taking 8 Elavil a day to stay on an even keel, because I was absolutely miserable in that place. I hated it. I just hated it. And I used to scream horrible things when I was drunk out my front door, like the children would be playing in the street, you know, and they had all come from the Brooklyn and Bronx and the Queens, and what did they know about the country? I knew the country. I grew up in North Jersey, you know. And so I would scream stuff out the front door like, slum children will be slum children. My children will come in the house. And my poor husband would be hiding somewhere, sure somebody was going to come and burn our front yard, or we would be run out of town. But that is where alcohol took me. You know, that's exactly where alcohol took me. My drinking just increased. One night he called me from Chicago. We were living in this horrible place. And he said to me, we're moving. And I said, is tomorrow too soon? And he said, well, wouldn't you like to know where we're going? And I said, any place but here. And he said, well, I got good news for you. He said, we're going to San Francisco. And that was my dream. I mean, I have to say, of all the places that I lived. And I loved it. And I loved it because San Francisco was near the wine country. And see, I had just been this 7 and 7 kid, and then I did get introduced to scotch, and I did really love scotch. But you know what? If you're an alcoholic, you would drink scotch in the morning. But you're living in California. There's nothing wrong with wine. And so I got into the wine. And I had my under-the-sink wine, as I liked to call it. I mean, I could walk down the aisle of the Safeway and buy this big gaboony thing, you know, and stick it under there. But pretty soon I started to realize that was disappearing kind of fast, too. And at this point in time, which was the mid-70s, I had become a morning drinker, and my children would go off to school, and I would take a coffee mug, and I'd fill it with wine. And I guess my friends knew too, but they, you know, enabled me, because if I went to their house in the morning, they'd ask me if I wanted wine, and I'd say, of course. You know, there'd have to be something wrong with me if I didn't. It was right around in that time that my mother got very, very ill. My mother developed throat cancer, and she was told two things when she had her first surgery. She was told that she had to stop smoking, and she had to stop drinking, because it was not good for her particular cancer. And my mother did not quit smoking, and my mother did not quit drinking. And she went through some terrible, terrible times. I commuted to Florida pretty much every couple of weeks or so while she was so sick. She was in the hospital, and she had made me make a pact with her at some point in time. I can't exactly remember when. It had to be early on in the 60s or so. She used to tease me, and she would say, well, you know, Jean, if anything ever happens when I can't take care of myself, or I've become a burden to the family, and she said, I want you to promise me you'll pull the plugs. And I said, sure, I'll do that. I can do that, Mommy, sure. Well, we reached a point in place and time in that hospital in Vero Beach, Florida, where my mother had most of her voice box removed, and she wrote me a note on a slate, and she told me she couldn't stand the pain anymore, and she wanted me to pull a plug. And I couldn't do it. I just couldn't do it. So I took the coward's way out, and I went and I got drunk, and I stayed drunk. And from March of 1976 until May of 1983, I never drew a sober breath. And I didn't care. My dad got remarried 10 months after my mother died. He married an old family friend. It was fine with us. I remember my dad saying this. My dad used to tell me that he went to bed to nothing and he got up to nothing. And regardless of how bad she had been, at least, you know, she had been there. And he got married on February the 22nd of 1977. And on February the 24th of 1977, approximately 36 hours later, he dropped dead of a massive coronary. And he was my hero. He was my hero. What I found at that point in time was nobody needed me. Now, my husband was climbing the corporate ladder, and he didn't need me. My kids were older, and my kids didn't need me. And there's a lot of us that are getting older find that, and I find this is very true, where the parent becomes the child and the child becomes the parent. And my parents had become the children, and now I had nobody, and nobody needed me. And I remember nothing about my mother's funeral, and I remember nothing about my dad's funeral. And God has given me a wonderful gift. God has given me a wonderful gift. Because just a month ago, I lost one of my brothers. And he had a terrible battle with cancer. It was horrible. It was horrible. But God gave me the gift of being able to go and being able to sit with him, and to hold his hand, and to rub his forehead, and to love him, and to let him go. And I didn't need to go get drunk, and I didn't need to bury it, and I didn't need to hide it. And what a miracle. What an absolute miracle. You know? I sat with him the whole day before he died. His whole family was there just loving him. And I am so grateful to the God of my understanding for having given me that chance. Because when I did my eighth and my ninth step, and I like to talk about this too when I share. I had to make amends to my mom and my dad, and I didn't know how to do it. And I mean, they were dead, you know. And I've heard about writing a letter, you know, and that's a good way. But I have God again brought me here. I was in South Carolina. My daughter was very pregnant with my granddaughter, and they were having a shower for her in June of that year, and 19, whenever she was born, 93. And at the same time, my aunt died. And my aunt was to be buried in the same cemetery where my parents are now. You know, this was God. This was a God incident. And that's what I like to call the things that happened to me and for me. This was a God incident. And I found I was going to be here, and I have a wonderful friend in Charleston who's a Lutheran priest, and he's in recovery. And I said to Paul, I said, Paul, I'm going to be there. So I feel that this is the sign that God wants me to go and do this ninth step amends, and I don't know how to do it. And he said, well, Jean, this is what I would suggest. And so it worked so well for me that I like to talk about it from the podium. He said to me, he wanted me to go, and he wanted me to stand at the foot of their graves. And he wanted me to very quietly just say whatever it was that I felt that I had to say. And because as rotten as that place was to grow up in, you know, they didn't know any better, and they did the very best that they could. I think sometimes I've always had to look at what was the example. You know, what was the example? They didn't have very good role models. But they did the best that they could. And I didn't always make their life so easy. I really did not make their life so easy, you know. I tried to be as good as I could, but, I mean, after all, I'm human, and there were points in time when I couldn't. And so he told me to go, and he told me to stand at the foot, and he told me to say whatever it was that I wanted to say. And then he told me that he wanted me to go walk around, and he wanted me to stand at the head. And he wanted me to look back at where I had just been, and he wanted me to imagine what my mom and my dad saw. And that was, for me, one of the most freeing experiences of my life. Because I knew that what they saw was a sober woman contributing to society, trying to be a good mother and trying to be a good grandmother, trying to be a good employee, trying to do the very best that I could. And I am so grateful for that experience. And when we went and we buried Tom a month ago, I did the same thing again. Because they're right, he's here, Tom is here, and my mom and my dad are right here. And I did it one more time. Because I wanted to see what they saw compared to 1993. What did they see that was different? How had I changed? What had I done? What have I accomplished that would make them proud of me today? And it is the most freeing experience that I've had in my sobriety. It sealed all of that, those wounds, and it just sort of made it right. It just made it right. And I can't even remember what year it was now, about 1980, I guess it was. My husband decided that he wanted a house on the ocean, and he'd worked hard for it, and he deserved it. And so he moved me to Seagirt, New Jersey. Now, my in-laws lived in Seagirt. They bought that house, the house I'm in now. Actually, my mother-in-law's probably rolling around in her grave because she's not overly thrilled that I am in her house. I was not her favorite person. I was capable of bringing children into the world. I was not capable of raising them. So, anyway, we moved every summer from 1966 to 1980. I brought my children to Seagirt. It didn't make any difference where we lived. Made no difference. We came to Seagirt and we spent the summer. It didn't matter with my husband because he traveled all over the world. So wherever he lit, he would come, and he had visiting privileges. And my husband moved me to a house on the ocean, 5 blocks from my in-laws. My children were in college. My husband was traveling the world. and I was a full-blown alcoholic almost at the end of my rope. My in-laws parked in front of my house every single solitary day to watch my comings and goings, make sure that I was home when I was supposed to be home and not home or whatever. Used to drive me nuts, just drove me crazy. So, of course, you know, because I'm so paranoid, I drank some more. I found that drinking at home became very expensive. I knew my husband was marking the bottle of scotch that I was positive he was doing it. He told me later he was not, but I have to believe him, but I was sure he was doing that. So because I am so, you know, our first step talks about admitting we're powerless over alcohol and that our lives had become unmanageable. Now, I did not see the unmanageability or the insanity that we talk about in the second step until I'd been sober for a while. But this is the insanity and the unmanageability of my disease. I had a half gallon of Dewar's in my closet. To this day, I cannot tell you why I did not drink out of that bottle. But I can tell you that I drank out of the bar scotch, and then I knew approximately, I had it eyeballed, where that line had been. And so I would then go into my closet, and I would get the half gallon of Dewar's, and I would decant it into this bottle that I knew that he was marking. But you know, sometimes I put too much back in. So then I had to drink it out. And sometimes I drank out too much, so I had to put it back in. And you know what? I did not see any insanity, and I did not see any unmanageability at all at the time. At the time. You know, the insanity of my disease was that when I was sitting in my own home, having a scotch and soda, and the doorbell rang, I put it in the refrigerator because I didn't want anybody to see that I was drinking, and it was 2:00 in the afternoon. You know, I also, along with a lot of other people that I know and I've heard share, I parceled my bottles out to the trash man because I know that the secret garbage men really care about how many bottles are in my trash. I mean, I know this for a fact. I'm sure that they stop every Monday and Thursday, you know, and they're disappointed now because they don't see any, except when I have to rent my house in the summer, and that's another story. Right? I mean, absolute insanity. Insanity. I kept a list in my glove box of the liquor stores that I went to, and I put a check mark after I'd been because I could never remember where I went. And if I went to one too often, they're going to know that I'm an alcoholic. You know, they're going to know this. So I got to be really careful about, you know, the procedure and how, where I go. Never saw the insanity of my disease. I became a bar drinker. I can tell you every bar in Monmouth and Ocean Counties that opens up at 6:00 in the morning, 7:00 in the morning, the ones that stay open till 2, 3, 4:00 in the morning. I can tell you that because I was there. My morals went out the window, and I didn't care. The only thing that was important to me was where I was going to get that drink. That drink had become my primary purpose in life, was to get that drink, and I needed to know that I was going to be able to get it. Toward the very end of my drinking, I would get up in the morning and crawl on my hands and knees, and I would get to the wine that was under the sink, and I would get the coffee mug, and I would put some ice cubes in it, and I would pour some wine in, and I would stand over my sink, and I would drink it down, and I would throw it up. And I would drink it down, and I would throw it up. And I knew eventually it would stay down. And once it stayed, I could take a shower and put some makeup on so that at least the outside looked half decent and I could go to the bar. I mean, that was my whole thing. My whole being active in my community and everything went out the window. I just didn't care. I just did not care. I moved an unemployed house painter into my house. while my husband was traveling, because that sounded like a good idea at the time. My husband came home early. He wasn't happy. I didn't understand why he wasn't happy. I mean, after all, if you had to live like I lived, you'd drink too. I mean, you know, you would do this. And so what I did was, in my infinite wisdom, is I took my furs in one hand and I took my gold in the other, and I stood at the bottom of the stairs of my million-dollar house on the ocean in Seagirt, New Jersey, and I said, I'm not going to live like this anymore. And the truth of the matter is, I haven't. I went off to Hoboken on my last drunk, which was long before Hoboken became the yuppie capital of the world. When I was in Hoboken back in 1983, believe me when I tell you, it was not a place that a nice girl from Seagirt in her cords and her Fair Isle sweater belonged. I looked a little bit out of place. I sort of stood out. There was some man in a big limousine that started to hand me $100 bills. I never did figure out what that was for. I pray to God that I never do find out. And a key to an apartment in Manhattan, and so my unemployed house painter and I, that's where we went. And eventually, I can tell you, eventually I was someplace in New Brunswick, East Brunswick, who knows, someplace around in there. And I ended up in a sleazy motel room on Route 9 in Lakewood or Howell or someplace there. It was such a class act that it had no telephone. I had an empty half gallon of Dewar's. I had alcoholic paralysis. I crawled on my hands and knees for 2 days. I should have died. I should have died. I know that. I would like to believe that God's not finished with me yet. That's what I'd like to believe. I can't tell you how I got home. I have no idea. My husband put me on a plane to Nebraska to go see my brother Neil, who has he's a counselor or whatever. He works with juvenile delinquents, folks, is what he does. And I was no better than a juvenile delinquent, and my husband didn't know what to do with me. So he put me on this plane. He handed me a letter as I got on that told me I wasn't welcome in my own home anymore, that he was suing me for divorce, and that he could neither forgive nor forget my behavior. And I went out with Neil, and I spent about a week there, and he told me that I needed to go to rehab. And I asked him how long that would take, and he said probably about 4 months, because I didn't realize how sick I was. And I said, okay, well, I got no home, so that sounds, well, at least be a roof over my head, you know. And so I called home, and I told my husband that I was ready to go, and he said, well, good, because you're going to Carrier Clinic, and it's a 28-day program. And as I sit here tonight, I can remember looking Neil square in the eye, I'm going to a 28-day program. And I was gone for 4 months and 10 days. So somebody knew a little bit more than I did. I went to Carrier Clinic. I knew absolutely nothing about the disease of alcoholism. I was so relieved, as most of us are, when I found out I wasn't crazy, because they really believed I was nuts. I really thought that. And I had a wonderful counselor there by the name of Jane Albers, who is still one of my dearest friends and happens to live in Wilmington, North Carolina. So when I lived in South Carolina, I was able to see a lot of her. And she strongly urged me to go to Alina Lodge, and I didn't want to go. Now, I didn't want to go to Alina Lodge for perfectly good reason. They wouldn't let me smoke my menthol cigarettes. I would have to give up my menthol cigarettes. How dare they? Didn't they know who I was? No. But I condescended because, after all, I had no home. And this was going to be a little bit longer that I would have a roof over my head. And I went to Alina Lodge, and I was terrified of Mrs. D when I first met her. I was privileged. She's left us and gone a few years now. I was privileged to know her and prosper is a good word from her teachings. She would walk around the dining room, and I'll never forget it, and she would walk and she would come up, she would put her hands on your shoulders and she would say, and how are you this evening? And you would say, fine, thank you, Mrs. D. And and she would say, according to whose standards? And I didn't know the answer. In the beginning, I didn't know the answer. Today, I know the answer. The answer is according to my standards. Because no matter where I go, I take me with me. And I have to learn to, I had to learn to live with me. I had to learn to live with me. It was at Alina Lodge that I learned to knock down those horrible brick walls that I had built up for so many, many years. You know, I was afraid to let you in. I didn't want you to know who I was, because if you really knew who I was, you wouldn't like me. And I couldn't take rejection, and I couldn't take abandonment. Abandonment is still my biggest issue in my life. Abandonment is still my biggest issue. I've had two husbands that I feel abandoned me. I had parents who abandoned me. I've had a couple of relationships in recovery, and they've ended for whatever reason, and to me that's been an abandonment. It's an issue that I have to work on all the time, just all the time, because and it still makes me afraid, or leery is a really good word, to get myself into a really close relationship, because I'm so convinced that that person will leave me. And then what do? You know, I'm one of those, as a lot of women I know, and I'm sure men too, when I give 110%. I just do. And I can't take, my expectations get in my way, and then I get disappointed. And that's not good for me. You know, that's not good for me. But anyway, it was there that I learned to knock down these walls that I'd spent so many years building up. And as I just told you, they're not gone. That'd be a lie if I told you they were gone. But they're not as high as they used to be. You know, they're just not as high as they used to be. And I left Alina Lodge, and I was really grateful. And I came back here, and I walked the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I started my road to recovery. I started to apply the steps, all of them, in my life on a daily basis. The first three steps for me are the giving up steps. And the next three steps, 4, 5, and 6, are the owning up steps. And 7, 8, and 9 for me are the paying up steps. And last but not least, 10, 11, and 12 for me are the growing up steps. And I find if I apply them on that basis in my life goes pretty well. The steps, and the, as presented in this big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, is just really important to me. I still make 6 meetings a week. It's very important to me to do that. Well, I try to make 6. Let me put it that way. Sometimes, you know, I can't do that all. When I first got sober, when I first walked through the doors at Alcoholics Anonymous, I got out of Alina Lodge in September, and in November I found myself in a divorce court, and I watched 24 years of marriage go down the tubes because. And that was my husband's choice. 10 months later, I got a phone call, 8:15 in the morning on August 18th, 1984, with a child screaming into the telephone that I had to hurry up and get up to Seeger because Daddy was dead. And my children had come down that morning, and they found their father dead on the sofa. He was 49 years old and had died of a massive coronary. The man loved me to the day he died, and I know he watches over me every day now, and I know that. I know that for a fact. I talk to him all the time. He was my hero, too. And I miss him, because I think we could have made a go of it if we'd been given the opportunity, but we weren't. And the good thing that came out of that was that my children had a sober mother. And that was really important. They didn't have to worry about what to do with me. I'm going to run out of time, and I gotta do what I gotta do. I discovered that year, next year, that I had to go to work. I was 47 years old, folks. I had never held a job in my life. Somebody always took care of me. Somebody always provided. Nobody was providing for me now. And I needed a roof over my head and food in my mouth and clothes on my back, and nobody was giving it to me, and I discovered that I had to go and do it. And there was a wonderful attorney in West Long Branch by the name of Peter Shaw, who hired me cold off the street, and he taught me everything that I know. And because of the things that Peter taught me when I went to South Carolina, I was able to hold a fabulous, fabulous job doing mass tort litigation and flying all over the country and representing my law firm and interviewing different people, different plaintiffs, and it was all because of what he taught me. And a couple of years ago, I had to make a big decision. I was sitting at a As Bill Sees It meeting. I'll never forget it. My daughter had called me maybe 6 months before and asked me if I would ever consider coming back to New Jersey, and I said, I'll think about it. And I was sitting at an As Bill Sees It in like November or December of that year. That was probably 98. And I was sharing, I can't tell you where it came from, and out of my mouth I announced to that whole group that I was moving back to New Jersey, and I cannot tell you where those words came from. I can't tell you because I don't know. And in January I lost my job, and I called my daughter and I said, I got a big decision here, you know. Do I get another job in Charleston, which I could have done, and stay here with no family? Or do I come back to New Jersey and live in your grandmother's house, which you've offered me, as long as I, you know, pay my way, and watch my grandchildren grow? And as much as I hate the weather, it was a good decision. And I've been back almost 5 years now, and it's been wonderful. It's been wonderful. And I was a little fish in a, you know, I was the big fish in the little pond when I was down there, and then I came back and I was a little fish in the big pond, and I had to reach out one more time. God, I hate doing that, you know. But I have so many wonderful people in my life today. I have traveled all over this country, and I know people in all the states. There's no place I can go, I don't go, that I don't walk into a meeting and I don't know somebody. You know, I went on a sober cruise last November. I'm going on a sober cruise to Alaska in August. And I've just been asked to be a speaker on a Caribbean cruise in November. And I have the flyers for anybody who would like to come with me. You know, I do have the flyers in the car. Life is good. Life is good. You know, I have people today who truly love me. You know, when you look at me and you tell me you love me, I know you love me. And when I look at you and I tell you I love you, know that I love you. I really and truly do. The program of Alcoholics Anonymous and the fellowship have carried me for almost 21 years. Without you, I could not have done it. Without the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'd be dead. You know, there is nothing so important to me that a drink is going to fix. Not today. Billy Noonan tells this wonderful story about this recovery thing being a... God, he broke his anonymity again. Sorry. This is life. We all know that recovery is a partnership. You know? It's me and God. That's what this is. And I row and God steers. And one day I look at God and I say, you know what, God? I'm really tired of rowing. What I want to do is I want to steer. And God says to me, that's fine, Gene, you go right ahead. But you remember, I don't row. And as long as I keep that in my mind, I'm okay. I'm going to close. I got about a minute, maybe. So, I never close any talk that I've ever given without doing this. So what I'm going to do is invite you, if you care, to just sit back. Relax, close your eyes, and we're going to go on a little trip here. This was sent to me by a wonderful, wonderful old gentleman in Tennessee. And he wrote me a note, and it says, every time you read this, remember that an old country boy in Tennessee loves you. And you can mark your words that I will go home tonight and call him, and I will tell him that one more time I shared the station. Tucked away in our subconscious is an idyllic vision. We see ourselves on a long trip that spans the continent. We are traveling by train. Out the windows we drink in the passing scene of children waving at a crossing, of cattle grazing, of smoke pouring from a power plant, of rows of corn and wheat, of flatlands and valleys, of mountain skylines and village halls. But uppermost in our minds is the final destination. On a certain day, at a certain hour, we will pull into the station. Once we get there, so many dreams will come true. How restlessly we pace the aisles, damning the minutes for loitering, waiting for the station. When we reach the station, that will be it, we cry. When I'm 18, when I put the last kid through college, when I get a promotion, when I reach the age of retirement, I shall live happily ever after. Sooner or later, we must realize there is no station, no one place to arrive. The true joy of life is the trip. The station is only a dream. It constantly outdistances us. It isn't the burdens of today that drive men mad. It is the regrets over yesterday and the fear of tomorrow. Regret and fear are twin thieves who rob us of today. So stop pacing the aisles and counting the miles. Instead, climb more mountains, eat more ice cream, go barefoot more often, watch more sunsets, laugh more, cry less. Life must be lived as we go along. The station will come soon enough. And for this alcoholic, if I don't take my sobriety seriously, God will take it away. He'll give it to someone who will, and I can't afford that. Thank you.